Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 80, where Miranda, Sam, Tom, and Sarah are discussing Sumantra Ghoshal's article, Bad Management Theories Are Destroying Good Management Practices, published in Academy of Management Learning and Education in 2005. If you missed part one, you can access it on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. So we ended part one with quite some provocative thoughts because we've talked quite a bit about what Ghoshal was critiquing the business schools about, but where do we kind of go with this? And I think a good place to start would be to think about the purposes of the business school, because we were touching on that was something that really was kind of absent. Well, the more we talked about it, the more we realized what a gap that is. It's really hard to point to a unifying purpose, because let's consider the following. The purpose for the school to have students, the students are there to basically receive an education and to go forth and apply that education. You have the school's purpose connected with the organizations to which their students would purportedly go to, which may include, for the entrepreneurs among the students, would include the businesses that they create. So, for example, I'm sure that your respective schools are all wonderful schools. They rely heavily on their reputation, so that a corporation knowing that London Business School or somebody has Warwick or has Said or whatever on their resume, that means something. So there's a purpose there for the organizations to want to draw in talent from who have the school in their background. There's wider society. I think the business schools are not just about business. Ultimately, business is also about society, because business connects with society. And in some ways, because, of course, there's to the statement made in part one that to those who have, much more will be asked. If you come out of with a business education, then you're looked upon as some sort of a role model or a leadership role, a spokesperson role, or something else, basically connecting with society. Society looks to its business leaders as leaders of a broader, in a broader sense. And then finally, there's also the what the school owes the profession. And I'm not talking profession necessarily in the Andrew Abbott sense, because Ghoshal himself said that business has kind of departed from professionalism in that sense. We're talking about basically the community of practice. Let's use that term instead. A community of practice of business, of executive leadership, to steward the domain of expert knowledge, to cultivate these theories, to cultivate research and all that in order to improve the broader community of business leaders. Now, we should think that if we were really to try to break down the purpose for any given business school, there's a mix of these four directions that are probably going to be a little bit different. Some are probably going to be more aimed at the students. Some are going to be more aimed at the profession if it's a research institute. I think that there's a lot of room to talk about a wide range of kind of purposes to what we have these schools for and what the schools offer itself or outside of the walls.
Yes, Tom, I think that's an interesting point. And I do appreciate the diversity of business schools, as we've talked about previously, the sort of diversity of students that also sit within the business schools. I think, again, to a certain extent, that definitely builds into what is the measure of success? What are we aiming for? What are the goals? What are the objectives? Who do we have to make happy? What are the politics, internally speaking? So I think there is room to maybe open up this conversation around different types of business schools and seeing really where do these sort of candidates, where do these students that then end up in top positions, which are the ones that they they are the greatest, that they have the greatest impact from or on, actually. So yeah, I would definitely sort of, maybe if I could sort of take this study, this reflection one step further, I would definitely look into pieces of research around different business schools and who they sort of have to respond to in terms of identity.
The pair, the companion to identity, is also legitimacy. And there is a part towards the end of the article that talks about legitimacy and the role of institutions in taking forward the agenda of the entire article. So both as individuals and collectively, business school alumni and corporate leaders can exert significant pressures to realign the perspectives and priorities of the institutions they support. This is the second to last paragraph on page 89. And so this is the closing the circle for the role of individuals, the role of organizations, and then the role of institutions, which, as I'm sure we've discussed in many different episodes, is a cornerstone of organizational theory.
Right. And one of the things that I saw that, and then combining that with the idea that what we talked about in part one, that the business school academics, that Ghoshal says that they are the ones who really need to promote the change. There is something to be said about how corporate leaders could very easily overcome whatever internal change, you know, like if the corporate leaders still embrace some of the theories that Ghoshal is critiquing, and if they continue to lean on or expect graduates of the schools to be educated a certain way or to behave a certain way, it's really, really hard to see how that would change. So in essence, it almost has to be a multi-pronged effort across all four of those communities, all four of the eight elements that the business school is interacting with. At the fundamental level, it needs a different relationship with, it needs to realign the purpose of it with society writ large, who has a particular understanding of why the private sector exists, how it serves them or what have you. With the organizations themselves, you got to say, hey, listen, you know, how do you do this? Listen, Mr. Executive Leader, who we graduated from our school 20 years ago and has done so brilliantly, by the way, you're wrong and you need to change. there's, you know, obviously that would never be said so directly, but that would be kind of the message somehow that their expectations of what is business, in addition to who they should be welcoming into their organization, would need to change somehow. And past efforts at social responsibility have not really not succeeded in changing those minds.
Yes, Dom, and I think another issue in this kind of broad question of what should we, all of the actors that are involved in this, what should each of us do, is also, I don't know what you guys thought about this article and what you think Ghoshal's recommendation is, whether we need to teach different theories or whether we need to teach theory differently. Because I think there's a bit of both across the article. And going back to Sarah's comment earlier in the first part about, you know, the kind of, you kind of finish the article expecting to read, okay, so what are the next steps or what are we looking at? And I also missed, just from looking at the title, you know, good management practices. I was kind of missing, you know, where are these good management practices that bad theories are destroying? Do they just exist and we're not studying them? Or what are kind of examples of these good management practices that exist apart from theory and that theories then come in and, you know, destroy these practices?
I think that's a really interesting point. And to a certain extent, it also brings up in my mind the question of how do business schools keep a lifeline, a connection with their alumni? What have they done afterwards? What is the legacy in the good and in the bad? And I think, unfortunately, that lifeline, that connection, that isn't sort of a center priority, let's put it that way. But also there is the fact that, unfortunately, we... as human beings and as the news sort of surrounds us, we are just more, we remember more the bad news. So the question that Samantha posed was, what are these good management practices? Maybe the underlying question is, how can we recognize them and how can we just make them more center stage? And I think that would be also a good sort of balance between this gloomy vision and acknowledging that there's actually also something else out there and that we could continue nurturing that instead.
Yes, and I would also add just a quick thing. How do we recognize these good practices, studying them, theorize about them, but then how do we prevent these theories from becoming truth claims that then kind of have a negative effect in other types of organizations as well?
It's an excellent question because when we really get down to it, good management practices are ultimately very context dependent, aren't they? We teach, in my institution, we teach change and we teach systems thinking. And we constantly remind them, hey, what works today may not work tomorrow or may not work in a different particular setting. And so good management practices, you know, it would be very easy for us to collect a whole bunch of episodes of good management outcomes. They may not even be good practices, but the outcomes were terrific. And then try to replicate it somewhere else. And of course, in a different context, the results may very well be different. There may be some general learnings about it or whatever, but I think it kind of gets to this whole idea. Maybe we're not asking the right question in terms of what is a good management theory, but is theory actually what we want to base everything on? In some recent episodes, we've sort of delved into pragmatism. And in pragmatism, everything is built on experience as opposed to theory. This would be a way of trying to get away from what Ghoshal was complaining about in terms of ideology and think about context. How do we learn so that if we have a good outcome, we come to better understand what was good that led to that outcome or contributed to that outcome? And ultimately, how do we know when a good outcome is going to start fading because the situation is changing? Maybe other people are trying to, they recognize that, oh, we had an advantage and now our competitors are going to try to find a way to either leverage that advantage or try to take our advantage away and things of that nature. It's a little bit less theoretical, its foundation. It's a little bit more oriented on practice and oriented on experience, on innovation, on change, and that sort of a thing.
That's what's so interesting about the opportunity that the newest journal under the Academy of Management, the Academy of Management Discoveries, provides for scholars, which is that the mandate to make big leaps of theory development and to bring new data sets, new contexts, new ways of addressing fundamental or applied questions is minimized in the benefit of interest and pragmatism and exploration and inspiring future research. And I have been fortunate to review a few papers for the journal. And although it's the same scholars that we have elsewhere in the profession, it is definitely, I can tell you, working in a very different way. And it's refreshing and enjoyable. And I think if we had had AMD at the time that this paper came out, that might have been a connection across these two different journals. You don't often see connection across different academy journals, let alone people connecting across different management scholarship journals and outlets. But that could have been some place that this provocative essay could have taken us, which is to say that you don't need to take a positive approach to knowledge. You don't need to take theory building into it. You don't even need to take rigorous data or natural experimentation for causal identification involved in there. There might be a solution elsewhere.
So maybe your observation about AMD kind of answers Tom's question of whether we necessarily want theories in this, in the sense that they've been understood, that they're predominantly understood as a main output of research. And this makes me think as well of, I mean, I think we do want some version of theory. We just need to kind of be very clear on what we mean when we're talking about theory, right? And this makes me think about, you know, middle range theory, for example, where you kind of try and explain, you know, you're not providing kind of universal, all-encompassing explanations. And I think this is something that gets done and gets used a lot in management.
Yeah, I think to the question of what type of theory, I think at least my reading of the article was it's not really the theory, but the assumptions around human nature that is problematic, and how these nest into the theory, and how then the theory, because it provides the good outcomes and so on, consequently validates or approves of that interpretation of human nature. So I'm just wondering, as soon as we acknowledge the complexity and the upsides of human nature, the generosity, the compassion, the care, the things that we know are there, may not be in everyone, maybe in different levels of quality, I don't know, but they are there. And if we put them back in theory, how does that radically change the theory? Or maybe it just adapts it to, or it, what happens to the theory per se? Or do we just have to scrap it and start from a blank, from the drawing board, basically?
That's an excellent question. I don't know if I have an answer to that. I guess, you know, what sort of spurs into my mind, you know, to what extent is business, you know, the question of business schools unique? How are other fields grappling with this? I have to believe that there's got to be other professions who are... I'm working in military education. We don't really quite have the same issue. It's a different one. I mean, when we think about education serving, you know, in this particular case, we're talking about the education serving a very specific client, the military to which the members belong. The theory... The ones that we explore the most are the most practical. I mean, there we're looking very, very short term. The things that we want to be able to arm the students with to be able to apply at the next job and to be able to carry forward for, you know, several years to when they get the experience to be able to think broader and then bring information back. In business, we're talking about much longer, you know, kind of talking about longer time frames too. I mean, there's sort of the aspect of, maybe at the undergraduate level, you're interested in being able to produce the student who can go to the field. And so the theorizing has a much more practical nature, whereas those who come back for the MBA or the DBA would be, you know, we want them to think more strategically if they're not going to go into the scholarly track. So, I mean, even there, you know, just like with what we talked about in part one, where there's different pockets of students, there's also kind of like, you know, what are we offering the different programs for? What are their different purposes? And how do the theories, you know, if we're going to design theories that are going to be aimed at producing tools for the undergraduates to be able to put into immediate application, and the theories that we would give to the DBAs and the MBAs in order to continue on with the scholarship side, you know, obviously you'd want all of that to be nested within the domain of expert knowledge. But that's very, very difficult because we're talking about human systems, human experience, trying to make sense of, you know, build theories around what it is that they either explains what they are experiencing and or explaining what should occur, what we would want them to do in a given situation. Does that make sense?
I think it would be very interesting to have a similar conversation to this in a group where you had people from schools that have become schools of management, and those who specify with sub programs in nonprofit management or in non-entrepreneurial organizations. So there's a large part of this article that talks about the denial of moral and ethical considerations. And for me, it's very interesting to think about the practice of management in these mission-driven organizations or in social enterprise, which is an organizational form in the UK that is gaining a lot of attention. And the fact that charities and good institutions are not exempt from scandals, as we know. So that the idea that's presented in this article, and I think they mention the word moral no fewer than 13 times, and ethics is somewhere around the same amount. The idea that if we had clean knowledge and moral and ethical considerations in our theories, that we would have avoided the crisis situations that were explained at the beginning that we discussed of the article that we discussed in part one, is to ignore, deny, or explain away the same sorts of scandals that happen in those previously good institutions. So I think it'd be interesting to go through the models that we've done in figure one, figure two, but also trying to get to the what should we do next step that Samantha brought up before, with the lens of at least nonprofit, but possibly also mission-driven organizations, and see if we come up with the same answers or potentially different answers.
I think that would be a wonderful one to, you know, to have with the medical profession. I think that that's a good example of a mission-driven organization that has to walk a very tight line between the professional provision of service, which is effectiveness, which is about, you know, providing the best care to the patient, versus the efficiency of being able to afford it. And obviously, this is not the sort of a tight line that can ever be resolved. It is a natural paradox. No matter how hard we try to make it less paradoxical, it's very, very difficult because it's and medical care is expensive, but it is so vital. COVID has shown that so much. So, yeah.
There is an actual section on page 86 that says, in the field of economics, too, such an endeavor appears to be in progress, as evidenced by the Conference on Economics, Values, and Organization that took place at Yale in April 1996. And it says the volume from the conference explores the two-way interaction between economic arrangements or institutions and preferences, including those regarding social status, that's my baby, and the well-being of others and ethical principles. Here, the example was saying even economists are looking at values in organizations. Even economists are trying to look at how economic arrangements and preferences interact or affect the well-being of others. And by the way, there are ethics. That's what I was trying to do with this example, to say that, but obviously, sorry, killed the discussion there.
Yeah, so what's happened since 1996 would be the question.
No, I think what got me was the what happened since 1996. And I was thinking, where was I in 1996? I was 11. And I can't remember much about that. I was an annoying teenager. So sorry, my mind completely went off track.
It is a very salient point, though, that, you know, every once in a while, I guess it must be a cyclic thing, but every once in a while, every profession has to go through this self-evaluation or self-assessment phase. And it's a natural part of being a profession. And we even discussed that in the episode we did on Abbott's system of professions. You know, professions compete in order to maintain their competitive advantage. They've got to be able to figure out, all right, what is our jurisdiction? What is this that we own, and how do we keep it and maintain it? And obviously, when it comes to matters of, you know, scandals, whether it's a sense of stagnation, whether it's a sense of competition from others, obviously people, you know, will want to get together and do this sort of assessment. But unfortunately, does anything actually come with it? Just taking that statement at face value of what they did in 1996, here it is, how many years later? It's almost 25 years later, and we're still talking about a lot of the same problems. And it's so one of the things I teach my students about change is the challenge of overcoming the cynicism towards change, because we keep talking about change and then nothing happens. You know, that I have to believe is a barrier to some of the things that Gashal is talking about in terms of changing the business school environment.
Well, if you take the call-out box that follows that on page 87, and this goes back to Samantha's point, so I'm going to throw it to her at the end. The call-out box says, in essence, social scientists carry an even greater social and moral responsibility than those who work in the physical sciences, because if they hide ideology in the pretense of science, they can cause much more harm. So this goes back to what Samantha was talking about before, and I'd like to invite her to take this one on.
Thanks, Sarah. Yeah, actually, that observation that Gashal makes towards the end is, I think I really liked it, to be honest. And I think for me, when I read that, I was like, yes, and that's why I wanted to work in the social sciences, because of this close connection and this kind of, you know, I mean, we complain all the time about how we are so, sometimes we're very detached from kind of the practical world, But then we read this kind of reflection and we see that actually the research and the theories and the concepts that we develop and what we teach in the classroom does have an effect in the real world, and in this case, a negative effect. And just to continue with this kind of also observation that Tom was making before about how most disciplines go through these challenges, it made me think also of, you know, another kind of field that I'm very familiar with and that I'm part of, which is educating public administrators, and how, you know, there was this big thing about bringing management theories and trying to teach public management. And then there was a big backlash about, okay, we're forgetting about the values and the sense of, you know, publicness that we should be teaching our students. And so now there's this, at least an effort or a notion that theories, kind of similar to what Bochelle is saying, that theories need to be taught in a more nuanced way and acknowledging kind of the assumptions and the limitations of these theories and trying to provide a richer amount of concepts and visions and values to students, I guess.
Yeah, and then going even one step further is the danger of the management fad. And I think that that's something that that has introduced some cynicism, because business fads, you know, basically something that is proffered for commercial purposes to promote an idea with a little bit too much promise, a little bit too much hype, has made it, I think, sometimes a little bit more difficult for organizations to embrace theory, regardless of whether it is. This is one of the things where anti-professionalism, which we, again, we talked about in the Abbott episode, the rejection of expertise, the rejection of all things academic as not being practical, as not being useful, as not being relevant, as not being realistic. That conversation has gotten a lot more strength in the course of the pandemic. That's going to be another barrier that has to be overcome just to even allow, say, the schools to have a say or to be able to connect better with the societies that they promise to work with. Perhaps indeed, you know, Sarah, I like your discussion about the nonprofit organizations or sort of some of the other entities, because yeah, indeed, their models are very, very different. Is there something to be said about trying to rethink what defines a successful organization? Why do we have organizations in the first place? Not just looking at the business school, but looking at the outcome. I mean, what kind of an organization do we need in order to ensure that the needs and wants, which is very different, the needs and wants of the society are fulfilled, satisfied, or what have you?
That's a very interesting observation, Tom. And I think it ties nicely with what I think Gauchel's objective in writing this reflection was, which is to acknowledge that we need to meet the demands. We need to kind of provide answers to the problems and the changing context of organizations and of managers and executives and the people that we're educating. So that, I think that applies, you know, that applied back then to some of the scandals that Gauchel mentions, and it applies now to COVID. And I guess the question is how quickly we can provide kind of good education to meet those challenges.
I think this would be a good point to link back to another episode we already have, 57, Steve Carr's Reward Systems, which again is usually taught at the individual level in terms of incentivizing performance among employees and trying to cut through the noise or distract from the evil alternative. But it would be very interesting to apply that at the level of organization or corporate governance, as Gauchel is asking us to hear, because the introduction where it's asking us to assume or agree with that the incentive systems are broken, if we take that as a provocation and ask, is that actually true, then I think we can apply the Carr article at a higher level here and perhaps give ourselves a little credit.
Yeah, I like bringing in Steve Kerr's article in this. I mean, the incentive system, is it broken or is it perverse? And I think that in some ways we can say that what Gauchel is talking about is the result of a perverse incentive system. It was incentives that essentially created the spiral of bad, you know, bad, in his words, theories polluting good management practices or polluting management practice, which then in turn returns to the school and gets reinforced because of, you know, we're incentivizing quantitative research. You know, it's essentially a very positivistic research. That is what the organizations, the client organizations essentially expect of people coming in from the business schools. It's definitely self-replicating. I mean, it's reinforcing. So trying to come up with alternative incentives is going to be a challenge because you're going to have to change how we measure scholarship. And this is just a natural problem with pragmatism in general. We're trying to move from traditional scientific research to a more pragmatic form or narrative form of research. You know, you have to change what constitutes fundamental measurements of success at the individual and the organizational level, how we measure good quality scholarship, because it's vastly different. And again, it gets back to, well, how do the corporations measure themselves, which again is right now, if it's been reinforced that it's all about shareholder value or how corporations compensate their managers or whatever, and all of that would have to be systemically relooked. That's why I like, again, going back to liking your nonprofit example, because you almost have to look at it. You almost have to find that total alternative paradigm that allows us to rethink some of these underpinnings that have reinforced the current system.
Well, it links to a pair of projects that I have that the umbrella nickname for them in English comes out to be Who Watches the Watchers, or Who Guards the Guards, which is a Qui Custodiet Ipsos Custodes in Latin, from a poem, a long poem. And so that goes to directly to the part of the article that's talking about governance and governance reform, and whether governance reform is necessary and sufficient for overall practice reform. Which is to say that even if we sitting here today nod along 15 years later and agree and take the temperature of the situation and go through the existing practices that we've had in governance reform, and there are at least two generations of scholars since for whom corporate governance is their bread and butter, like page 81 call out box, why do we not fundamentally rethink the corporate governance issue? So if we say, yes, we will fundamentally rethink the corporate governance issue, my rejoinder is, who governs the governors?
Yeah, that's a very good way to look at it, I think. And boy, you know, it's just like anything else in these sort of complex systems. You know, you've got to figure out how, you know, where's going to be your first touch point? And then how are you going to touch the whole system at once? Knowing full well that there's probably finite energy to do so. That's one of the other things that goes through my mind in terms of how are we going to break apart some sort of a phenomenon that's so systemically ingrained. You can't go in with try to do the butterfly effect thing and just go in and impact one thing and then the whole system unravels. No, the system responds and cancels your action or attempts to cancel your action. So then the other is to how to spread your influence to multiple points within the system, such as go to the corporate leaders, go to the look at the student body, tell high school students that what they think of as business school is going to change. It's going to be different, and still try to encourage them to come. Changing what society thinks of it's, you know, constitutes the leadership role of the business leaders within their areas, and try to touch all of that at once takes a massive effort, and it's also not a guaranteed path to success. There would be a lot of complexity, a lot of difficulty. I'm not saying that to say that we shouldn't do that, but what's got to happen, I would think, is some sort of a, like, you almost need an experiment. You need some venue to try to set something up to test things out and try to figure out what might be an alternative thought process, an alternative approach.
So I think this goes back to the question Miranda was proposing for the kind of end of the the discussion of, in an ideal world, after reading this article, what we would, you know, what do we want to do? What can we do? What would we like to see happening? And I don't know, I agree with you, Tom, that we can't, I mean, we don't have the power to affect all these different things that we've acknowledged throughout the discussion that need to be affected in order to see some positive change. I guess what I take from the article, I don't know, for me, it was a very important and valuable reflection what Gauchal is providing here. And I think it should inform the way, I mean, I do inductive research and grounded theory. So for me, it's definitely going to inform how I think of theories and the work that I do in acknowledging assumptions. In terms of teaching as well, I guess we've repeated numerous times throughout the discussion that we need to be more critical and acknowledge, you know, the kind of historical moments of these theories, observations that they were based in, their limitations, their assumptions, all these sorts of things that it might be a challenge to do so in a small program and in a small amount of time. But I think we should definitely try to do that.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Audner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Vili Leidon-Virta, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.